For a while on Sunday, TPC Southwind started to feel like Talladega. Wrecks and wheels coming off every way you looked. But Hideki Matsuyama survived the collapse and the rules controversy to win the FedEx St. Jude Championship. We're going to relive the wild turns that saw 70 guys become 50 as the playoffs move on to Denver. Jordan Spieth isn't one of those guys with a tee time for the second week of the playoffs. His season is over and the surgeon's knife awaits because of a lingering wrist injury. We're going to talk about the risks involved and what his process is with someone who has been there. And it's a huge week on the LPGA Tour. The AIG Women's British Open is being played on the old course in St Andrews. We're convening a roundtable on the significance and the storylines. Golf Today kicks off right now.
Golf Today.
Welcome into Golf Today on this Monday, August 19th.
I have no idea. Time is a vacuum.
A little bit there. It felt Sunday, the 18th, felt like pretty much a walk in the park for most of the day in Memphis for Hideki Matsuyama. The lead was 5, proven winner, closer, major champion. Then the wheels came off.
You know what? I'm always okay with some theatrics late on a Sunday, and we were delivered those yet again this weekend, which had me excited for certain. Hideki was able to secure that win in Memphis, but part of that story unfolded as Hideki headed to the 12th hole and was approached by a rules official. 5 holes earlier at the 7th, Matsuyama had stepped on a pitch mark that was off the green, but it was determined after a convo that it was far enough from his intended line of play so there would be no penalty. Take a look there. Chips it up with his third shot. Now, this became a story because on the 12th hole, they would revisit this rule, 8-1, and it's examples of the action that are likely to improve the conditions affecting the stroke that is likely to give a player a potential advantage. And that includes when a player repairs a pitch mark in the general area or replaces a divot in a divot hole a few yards in front of their ball on the line of play. That's the key phrase right there. Before making a stroke that might be affected by the pitch mark or divot hole. For example, a putt or low running chip. So in the weeds here a little bit, it ultimately ended up much ado about nothing, although maybe it did impact Hideki. But what do you make of all this?
I definitely think it's much ado about nothing. When you look at where the pitch mark was and you look at what ultimately proved to be Hideki Matsuyama's line of play, there's quite a discrepancy between the two. So I don't actually think there's anything untoward going on here. When Hideki was quite emphatic afterwards that it did not derail him. It didn't lead to the dramas that we saw.
But did it a little bit.
It had to. I mean, if a cop pulls you over to tell you that you're not speeding, you're going to start wondering, was I speeding? What did I do? You're going to think about it when you get back on the road.
Sure.
And that's what I think happened to Hideki Matsuyama. This idea, sure, it wasn't lingering over him. He wasn't left, after the conversation with Gary Young, the rules official, he wasn't left with the impression that he was going to face a 2-stroke penalty and that ought to impact how he then proceeded for the rest of the round. But he would certainly have become unsettled by noise around him, what was going on that he was not in control of.
Took him out of a rhythm, too, if you will.
It really did. But, you know, this is a guy who's proven the ability to close when it matters, because it's not just that he's won the Masters. The guy almost won a medal competing in Tokyo, in his home country, in the Olympics. He's actually won the Zozo PGA Tour event in his home country. He's won the Memorial. He's won in Phoenix. He's won the Genesis. The guy knows how to close big events on big courses against stiff competition. Yesterday was a perfect example of Hideki Matsuyama doing what Hideki Matsuyama does.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I loved how he packaged it. He said, I knew that I had to recalibrate for 17 and 18. I had to go get it. And then the birdie putt on 17, the approach on 18, told the story, made him a champion for the 10th time on the tour. I love that. What I didn't love is the sequence and how this played out. We talk about the rules official who did his job, made sure he dotted every I, crossed every T, and maybe that's why it took 5 holes of a delay for them to finally get to Hideki on 12, which then created the turbulence post-12 after that combo. But it took a while to get to the official, and he said that. He said, well, when it finally got to me, then I had to check all the boxes to make sure before we went out and had the conversation on 12 with Hideki. So I think the issue I have is what took so long to get to the head referee, the rules official, to then start sifting through, okay, what are the checks and balances here before I inevitably go out there on the 12th hole? I didn't like the delay. I think that was my biggest issue. They did share with Todd what they had to do, But when it got to him, I think that's the discrepancy I'm not okay
with. Well, I'd rather they be diligent than be hasty. And in this respect, I think they were being diligent because Gary Young did specify that they went specifically looking for different video angles
sure.
to ensure that the line of play was not actually anywhere close to where he the ultimately corrected that pitch mark that was on the very fringe of the green. And, you know, we've seen situations before where a narrative starts to take off on social media and builds up noise and the tour is perceived as
reacting too late or too slow.
Yeah, they generally are, but sometimes it's actually based in fact. This didn't seem to be a situation that is untoward in my mind in the sense that the tour officials went and did their homework and then went and told him there is no issue. After they talked to him, they made sure that his version of events squared up with what they were seeing on video, that he didn't think he did anything wrong, that his intended line of play was not actually over that pitch mark that he had corrected. And once they had cleared that, then as far as they were concerned, a bow was tied on it, job was done. They can't control what Hideki does after that, because if they had told Hideki on the eighth tee, you know what, we're going to go investigate for the next four
yeah,
holes.
And, they did, they,
and then
they tied a bow on it. Yeah. They said this is done.
So they didn't address it with Hideki until they had to, until they had a full sense of what had happened. It would be a lot worse had they hastily gone to Hideki Matsuyama and said, there may be an issue here. Keep playing. We'll get back to you. Yeah. That's a different scenario.
Yeah, well, the scenario was Hideki ultimately ended up winning this thing. So now as you project out with 2 weeks left in this playoff as they head to Denver for the BMW, what are now expectations for Hideki as he's entered this conversation joining Scotty and Xander?
Well, the guy is a proven closer. We just said that with all of the big events that he's won. But, you know, there's a lot of room to maneuver for these guys over the next couple of weeks. Scotty Scheffler, as we've just seen, is not going anywhere. He's in the top five every single week out there. That's why Rory McIlroy says he likes this playoff system because it gives other guys a chance to catch him. We've, in the earliest days of the FedEx Cup playoffs, when it was just a cumulative points thing, there was no staggered scoring at Eastlake, we saw scenarios where guys won the Tour Championship and had managed to take off one of the playoff events. And in no other sport could you actually see a scenario where somebody decides to take off a playoff series and they still end up winning a World Series, as it were. And so,
you know, this is a baseball reference there.
I'm not that fresh off the boat right now. But Hideki's got stiff competition. He's played his way into contention here. He's not known for a guy getting on hot streaks. He's not known as a guy who wins repeatedly. He's kind of the lightning in the bottle every few months with Hideki. He's not known as a week-in, week-out guy in the way that we're seeing out of Xander Schauffele and Scotty Scheffler. Those are still the two guys that I would look at for the next couple of weeks. Well, Jordan Spieth's season ended on Sunday, one of the earliest playoff exits in his career. He said he's having surgery to deal with a lingering wrist injury. Aaron Oberholzer had that surgery, and Aaron's going to be here to tell us what's involved and what the risks are. That's coming up next. The results have not been there for Jordan Spieth this year. Not really much in the way of top 10, certainly since the Masters, the week before the Masters, the Valero Texas Open, back in April. It seems like this is the right window to do it for Jordan Spieth right now. He'd be delaying the inevitable if he didn't, but he's not going to be a factor in the President's Cup. There is no wraparound season anymore, so he's got no playing obligations, save should he choose to show up for the Hero World Challenge in December, or even perhaps the PNC Championship with his father, Sean, at some point maybe in December as well. But he has a clear window now to give himself the opportunity to do the surgery that he needs to do, give himself time to recover and come back at 100%.
Well, Eamon, it was an interesting dichotomy listening to him speak there. It was kind of resembled or illustrated also what his golf game has been. And the dichotomy I'm talking about was there's frustration, clearly, that he's in this spot. He's frustrated with his finish in Memphis, but also with this lingering injury. But then there's an upbeat approach to it, like, yeah, I'm going to get this done. It's common. I'm going to be fine. I'm going to get back.
An air of resignation to it as well, isn't
yeah,
it? He just kind of knows that you can't put it off any longer.
Yeah, so I think it's a little bit of both, right? And that's what his golf game was. You see the flashes, and you remember who this guy is, a three-time major winner, and then you see the injury having an impact. So the interview and the sound and how he talked about it, it made that reference to the golf. But beyond that, as a fan of a guy whose resume right now is a Hall of Fame resume, if he never plays a meaningful swing of golf, again, takes another meaningful swing, that's not going to be the case. But if he did, it's a Hall of Fame career. I want to watch Jordan Spieth not be this kind of player with injury. I want him to get a fix. I want to see what he's got left in the tank because I think there's a lot of good golf left. So to me, I'm excited about this.
I think you're right about that. There is a lot of good golf left in Jordan Spieth, but in any athlete who's heading for surgery, there's got to be a level of trepidation because, you know, we Irish are fatalists. You always assume that yours is going to be the one that maybe has a little wrinkle in the recovery that perhaps you don't need. And Jordan Spieth's got to have a little bit of trepidation in that sense going forward. But he is at least giving himself the window to come back. And he's not eligible for the Century Tournament, which opens the season in 2025. Is he going to go all the way to Hawaii just to play the Sony? My guess is you're probably going to see Jordan Spieth most likely on the West Coast next year. Perhaps maybe it's the American Express or Phoenix.
Yeah, you mentioned trepidation, but athletes, they try to put that behind them, and they've got to think, hey, I can go do this. And if you're Jordan Spieth, you got to think, I know what I can do. And so I want to see a confident Jordan Spieth back on the course playing meaningful golf, and that means him being healthy. So him getting this done turns the page on all of that. Then we can't go, well, what's going on with Jordan? Well, hopefully it's a surgery that he recovers 100% from. We go out there and we get used to watching the guy we got accustomed to watching in years past.
And that isn't the guy we've been watching this year, actually. Let's take a look at Jordan Spieth's results in 2024. 22 starts already this season, 3 top 10s, best finish, a 3rd in the Century. That was all the way back in January, 66th in the FedEx Cup rankings, and that's why he's not making the journey to Denver. And someone who knows a lot about this particular issue and this surgery, because he's been there himself, is our colleague Aaron Overholzer. Aaron, good to see you. Can you explain to us exactly what the issue is here with Jordan Spieth on his wrist?
Well, it's simply, to put it in layman's terms, it's a torn tendon sheath. And there's a tendon sheath that wraps around the ulna bone here on your left hand up top here. And what he's got done is basically a tearing right here, where there's a tendon called the extensor carpal nares tendon that runs through that groove in the bone. And when you swing the golf club with a torn sheath like that, it pops in and out, and it can be very uncomfortable. Sometimes painful, sometimes not painful, but more times not. It's just extremely uncomfortable, and sometimes you don't know when it's going to happen. And I know that for Jordan, that's been a serious issue this year, that it's the infrequency of what's going to happen and when it's going to happen when he swings the golf club, especially when he makes contact with the ground.
AO, in hearing from Spieth, he's mentioned a few times here since we've gotten this news that he's asked around other golfers, and this is very common. Doesn't appear very common to me. Is this a common injury that you've heard of?
When I had the surgery done in 2010, to my knowledge, I was the only PGA Tour player that my doctor said to me that it had ever come to see him, at least, and had this done. I hadn't heard of anybody having this surgery when I went and had my surgery. Baseball players I'd heard have it. It is a stick sport kind of injury, but baseball players were the only thing that I remember him telling me about that they would have the same problems. So I can imagine maybe some hockey players would have that same issue. You know, any stick sport, you're probably going to get the same issues with your hands, and golf is no different.
Aaron, you mentioned an issue of discomfort, not necessarily always pain, but certainly discomfort. And you specifically mentioned when contacting the ground. Jordan Spieth's driver stats this year are terrific. Iron stats, something very different. Is that really where the issue comes into play? And is it discomfort, or is it the fear of potential discomfort?
The second point is spot on, Eamon. When you don't know what's going to happen, when you're going to make contact with the ground, you don't know if that tendon is going to pop out or it's going to stay in that way. It's always constantly in the back of your mind. I know it was for me. Thick rough, firm turf, Open Championship type turf. When we do get the firm bounce at certain places, Colonial comes to mind. That place, when it doesn't rain, can get brick hard. Those types of layouts in golf courses, when they get firm, they can be very, very difficult on the wrist. And that gets you thinking about certain things in the back of your mind that you don't want to think about. Off a tee, I experienced the same thing Jordan did. No issues off the tee, no problems at all. And I was able to hit my tee ball without any problem either. It always dealt with making contact with the ground and or heavy rough.
So, AO, as we assess this, I mean, it goes back, this injury, 16 months. You've kind of laid out some of the things he's battling. So knowing these unsavory finishes for quite a while now with Jordan Spieth, how much do you attribute the injury to that?
Oh, nearly all of it, if not all of it. It's very difficult, Jordan, to play when you've got this in the back of your mind. You think you can get through it. You think you can do certain things. And as great a player as Jordan is, not even he did the best he possibly could, I think, with this injury. He was given some good news from a doctor, from what I understand, that told him that at some point he saw a doctor. He'd relayed to me that the doctor told him, hey, look, you can't do any more damage, which is the same information I got when I found out what I did. But even though you can't do any more perceived damage, the damage is done psychologically, knowing that that tendon can pop in and out. So for him to do what he's done up to this point is fairly remarkable, and to play through this, because it's not something you can tape. There's nothing you can do for this outside of recreating that tendon sheath.
Golfers are particularly reluctant to go down the road of surgery, Aaron, for obvious reasons. You had surgery on your wrist in 2010, twice in 2010. It's not always a smooth process to come back, is it?
No. Jordan's in a much better place than I was. And the reason that was, for me, I was accumulating surgeries on this left hand, which is what ultimately took me out of the game. It was, I had four different surgeries on this left hand, and I'm missing bones and parts of bones in this left hand, which is what took me out of the game. Jordan's got this one surgery. And the surgeon that did my surgery, Randy Viola, he said, look, he was the last surgery. And he was like, look, this is your last chance. Because I don't know how many shots you have left in this wrist, but you're definitely on a ball count. You're definitely on a number before this wrist is done because of all the work that I had done prior to it. Now, in Jordan's regard, he doesn't have anything near what I had. Every surgery's serious, okay? Every surgery comes with potential complications and potential hazards. But as far as I'm concerned, if the surgeon that does this surgery does a proper job, does it the right way, Jordan should expect a full 100% recovery. Because since Randy Viola did this surgery on my wrist, I have played lots of rounds of golf between 2010 and now, a lot of rounds of golf, and some in PGA Tour competition before I finally called it quits. And I've had zero issues with the wrist in that regard. I've had zero issues with the extensor carpal nares tendon and the tendon sheath. It's a surgery that's fairly involved to a certain extent. It sounds simple, but like I said, there's no simple surgeries. And I think Jordan will get through this without a problem. I heard what he said about his timeline. That sounds about right. I would take more time. Hands are real tricky and they want to heal, and you want to give them a lot of time to heal. And if you don't give him that proper time to heal, you could have more complications in the future. So I think him getting the surgery ASAP as soon as possible is a really good thing for him, and he'll be ready to go, hopefully ready to go by Sony.
So when you say getting ready to go by Sony, also talking about taking even more time to get back to fully 100%, as you describe, what does that timetable then look like? And we can say, oh, this is a Jordan Spieth, maybe not from 2015, but this is a guy that's out there competing and looks like an entirely different golfer.
Everybody's different. I think once he realizes that this is solid, it's not going to break again, because if I can get into what the surgery entails, or at least what it entailed for me, it's basically what they do. If they do the surgery that they did for me, they take a piece of your tendon fascia or your fascia from your leg, and they recreate the sheath with that fascia from your leg, and they pin it down, recreating the tendon sheath with, I have 11 titanium pins in my ulna bone that recreate that tendon sheath. So it's not going anywhere. I mean, that sheath is solid in there. And so if they do that surgery properly, he's not going to have any issues. So his confidence, once he realizes that, that's going to come back. He's going to start trusting it into the ground. He's going to start trusting it through the thickest rough. He's going to start trusting it buried lies in the bunkers, and he's going to be fine.
He's talked about chipping and putting after 8 weeks, potentially hitting fuller shots after 12 weeks. He did say at the weekend, Aaron, that he thought about a potential sponsor invite to the Hero World Challenge, Tiger's event in the Bahamas in December. Does that seem on the optimistic side to you?
Let's see. That is, what, usually about the second week of December?
Yeah.
Somewhere in there. that's, you know, this surgery's come a long way, I would imagine, since I had it in 2010. It's 14 years later. So I would think that that he is going to be close, depending on the modalities that he uses and what's available to him as far as rehab and how much rehab he does. I did a lot of rehab with this, as obviously it was my fourth surgery, so I had to do a lot of rehab, but I had to take a lot more time than he did because of all the accumulation of surgeries. So I think it could be quicker for him. He could be ready to go by the hero, but I still think that's for me, that's fairly aggressive, but we'll see how it goes. I hope he is ready to go by the hero, because that would be a great sign.
To those AO that say this is a career crossroads for Jordan Spieth, how would you respond to that statement?
Well, he's getting, you know, he's not up there in age, but I mean, he's getting into what I would consider his mental and physical prime. He does have two kids, three and under. So that also takes a lot of your time. And I can promise you three and under is not an easy age to deal with as a parent, for those of us who have had kids at that age. So he's getting pulled in a lot of different directions at this time in his life. So a career crossroads. Yeah, I would say so. But I still think that career grand slam is very, very much alive for him. And he's got quite a few more years after this surgery. He's done with this surgery and this is behind him. He's got quite a few more years to get that career grand slam, which I do believe he's going to do.
Insight on this topic that we can't get from anyone else. Aaron, it's always good to spend time with you. And by the way, Max, the golden doodle is prowling behind you. I think he needs to go for a walk.
Star of the show.
Well, he already did that. I think he wants to go outside and chase lizards. That's what he wants to do.
Don't we all?
Thanks for the time, Aaron.
Thank you.
On second thought, I don't know if everybody wants to chase lizards. When golf today rolls on, it's roundtable time. We're getting together some of the game's best writers and opinion givers to talk about the hottest topics across the sport. Rex and Lab join us next. Will Rory's struggles continue in the BMW?
It's time now for a Golf Today roundtable as we bring in the Golf Channel team's version of Scotty Scheffler and Xander Schauffele, and I will leave it among themselves to decide who is who. Rex Huggard and Ryan Lavner, two senior writers for Golf Channel. Rex, I want to start with you. Do you think that the playoffs, even leaving aside the wheels coming off yesterday afternoon, have the playoffs gotten a little bit more dramatic traction just because of the creation of the signature events? So there's a lot more to play for these guys just being in the top 50 other than getting an extra week's work this season?
I think so. You look at that top 50 number and I feel like it's very random, and we could sit here and go round and round. Is that the right size for the signature events or not? But it certainly has meant something to the players now. I was talking with a player last week who didn't make it to the playoffs, and he felt like he had had a terrible season. And I had to explain to him that you only had a terrible season because the goalposts got moved. Now, that being said, yes, I think anybody who watched on Sunday in Memphis coming down the stretch, certainly what Hideki did coming down the stretch was entertaining, but you also had all that movement around the top 50. You had three guys who played their way in, three guys who played their way out. Nick Dunlap having to do what he did at the 18th hole. It adds an element of entertainment to the product. It adds an element of suspense that wasn't there before. I think Lav and I both made the argument in the podcast this week that this event, more so than any event, regular event on the PGA Tour schedule, is the most important.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, Rex. Like, I'm flying tomorrow to Denver to cover the BMW Championship, and I've always covered it because it was always a very important week. There's always the automatic qualifications that get determined for the Cup team, whether it's the Ryder Cup or the President's Cup, like it's going to be happening this week at the BMW. There's going to be the cut down from 50 to 30. That always felt like the most significant cut down because, yes, you're going to get into three major championships. It's going to put you in line for the FedEx Cup title back when, you know, $10 million for the first place was a big deal to these guys. Now, I would certainly argue that the FedEx St. Jude Championship is the most important event on the PGA Tour schedule, just making sure you're inside that top 50, just making sure you're going to be in line for those eight signature events. The PGA Tour sort of calculated the churn somewhere in the mid-30s. That's exactly what it's going to be. The players who moved inside and outside that top 50 for 2025, about 38%. That seems pretty good, and it's very important for those guys to get in that sort of gray area.
Lav, what impressed you most with what you watched with Hideki this past week in Memphis?
his resolve, his resilience. I think it's important to keep in mind that this was a player in Hideki Matsuyama who was outside the top 50 in the world rankings earlier this year when he's been one of the best players of his generation. And I think this summer is a really good reminder of what Hideki can do when he is in full flight. He's one of the best iron players, certainly of this generation. Then you pair it with what we saw at TPC Southwind, which was one of the best putting performances of his entire career. You look at the totality of it now with the playoff win. He's had a sneaky good year. 62 to win at Riviera, top 10s at the U.S. Open and the Players' Championship. Obviously, he had that bronze medal at the Olympics, and now you put it in also the same category with a playoff win and a chance to win the FedEx Cup. It's been a very sneaky good year for Hideki Matsuyama.
Rex, I'm curious if you think Hideki is a grow-the-game figure. I know we tend to reflexively say that he is, or how do we actually define that? Because he competes almost exclusively on the PGA Tour. If you take outside the Olympics and the Zozo, which was a co-sanctioned event played in Japan, a PGA Tour event that he won, he's played one event in Asia in the last 5 years. I mean, of the top players in the game, very few of them play less overseas than Hideki Matsuyama does. Is the iconic status enough? Does he need to compete overseas?
I think he probably should. I think maybe as he gets later in his career, if you look at how much he plays to begin with on the PGA Tour, I think his schedule's pretty full. But I will go the other way and say the three of us have all seen it week in and week out on the PGA Tour. Even Tiger Woods in his prime did not draw a media crowd the way Hideki Matsuyama does on a daily basis. He has an entourage of media that follow him everywhere he goes. And that starts on Tuesday of tournament week. And he talks to them after every single round, practice round or otherwise. And when you go back to Japan, I've been there twice, I believe, to cover the Zozo Championship. He is like a rock star moving around that place. So we know that golf is really popular in Japan. And I'm not quite sure they needed Hideki to make it more popular. But he is certainly a driving force in that part of the world. I think there's a reason why we keep hearing these rumors about LIV Golf wanting Hideki Matsuyama so badly to make the jump over to that league. Because they know they just wouldn't be buying a top player in that particular situation. They would be buying an entire region of the world. That's how much he moves the needle.
Lav, what do you make of the Jordan Spieth news? Obviously having the wrist surgery and he's going to be out for the foreseeable. Hope to get him back for next season, back and better than ever. But he's legitimately at a career crossroads right now. At 31 years old, he's been playing some lackluster golf, if you will, for a while now. Do you expect an uptick and a healthy return?
I certainly hope so. I think the PGA Tour and golf in general are better when Jordan Spieth is at the height of his powers. You look at what he's done since 2017 in his last major championship victory. It's been pretty paltry, just two wins on the PGA Tour, and you can kind of quibble with the quality and the strength of those victories in general. This has been an injury that has dogged him for the past year and a half, and I'm sure it was incredibly frustrating for Jordan Spieth, who had the best driving year of his career in 2024, to not even make the second leg of the playoffs. It was sort of uncertain just how much subconsciously that was affecting the rest of his game. I think the statistics speak for itself, being outside the top 100 in iron play, outside the top 100 in proximity of the hole with his wedge play, which has always been Jordan Spieth's bread and butter. I'm glad to see that he's not even going to try and tee it up sometime this fall, try and make a late push as one of the captain's picks for a President's Cup, or if he would even sort of lobby Jim Furyk to get one of those picks for the President's Cup. Just take the 3 to 4 months off to get healthy and see what he can do in 2025. Because I think, you know, he's still in his age 31 season. There's still plenty of good golf left.
And I think AO touched on this in the previous segment, and it's something that it is marvel. I've been amazed that Jordan Spieth has been able to play through this so far this season. It's not necessarily the injury. It's the unknown of not knowing when it's going to pop out of position. And he talked earlier this year about being at the Players' Championship, feeling like his game was in a good position. And early in the week, before the competition started, it just popped out. Subsequently, he didn't play very well. So to have that hanging over your head week in and week out on the PGA Tour, it's tough to compete that way. And AO put it really well. I'll also go the other way, and this goes to the conversation that Amy and I just had. This is sort of the reality of the modern tour. That top 50 number was clearly on Jordan's mind when he decided to go ahead and finish out this season. He probably would have been better off getting the surgery earlier if we start looking at the timetables and what Lab just pointed out what his schedule may be. But he needed to at least see, maybe I can crack that top 50, get into all the signature events next year. That's the reality of the modern tour.
Ryan, speaking of discomfort, there were triple-digit heat indexes out there every day last week in Memphis. These guys can wear shorts in a practice round, not in a tournament round. And it's not as though these guys are going to be wearing the kind of polyester Sansibel slacks that Rex still favours at this point. But is it time for the tour to just stop clutching its pearls and let these guys wear shorts in competition?
Isn't that one of the main sort of drawbacks or criticisms of LIV Golf, that this is not serious because they're playing in shorts during tournament
competition? But is it a valid criticism of them, I guess?
No, I mean, obviously, there's a safety reason, and it clearly did not cross the threshold when the PGA Tour thought it was unsafe for players to be wearing pants. I'm okay with it. I'm okay with the professionalism. I'm okay with it looking like a serious competition, particularly in the playoffs, if it becomes a point where you're pushing 115, 120 heat indexes, which I guess is certainly possible in Memphis and Atlanta this time of year, then yeah, I think some adjustments need to be made. But I'm all for seeing the guys in the pleated khakis at this point.
Rex, let's go back to Memphis and one of the guys who had a more forgettable week. Your biggest takeaway from Rory's struggles down there in Memphis?
First and foremost, seersucker is what I prefer to wear outside, Amy, in case you were curious. That's the kind of pants I want to wear. Rory's week shocked me, to be quite honest with you, because I'll go back to the Scottish Open when he played well. And every time I spoke with him that week, he talked about he felt like his swing was in a really good position. Same thing he said at the Open Championship, even though he obviously didn't get the result he wanted there. Same thing at the Olympics. Again, didn't get the result, but felt like his game was in a good position. You look at what he did and did not do in Memphis. He didn't hit the ball well. He didn't drive the ball well. He didn't putt the ball well. That added up to pretty much his worst week of the year. And I was pretty shocked by it because, again, he had been trending in the right direction. This is normally when we see him playing some of his best golf as he gets towards the end. I'll also make the argument on the other side. Between he and Jordan Spieth and Max Homa, those three are testaments to why I think there needs to be a cut, even in a 70-man event, because that was brutal to watch those three play golf over the weekend.
Ryan, over on the LIV Tour, our colleague Jaime Diaz reported in Golf Digest at the weekend, quoting sources saying that John Rahm was unhappy with his move to LIV 8 months ago. Greg Norman, of course, came out and said that he wasn't, which is, you know, kind of like Kim Jong-un saying everyone loves life in North Korea. What do you make of seeing John Rahm so far this year and his comments that he's made sometimes at PGA Tour events or major championships? I should say he sounds a little poignant for the tour that he lost. What would you conclude the current state of John Rahm is?
Well, first of all, a defense of Jaime Diaz, who we all know is as painstaking as it comes to his reporting and to his writing. He is not putting it out there simply to drum up controversy. That is what he is reporting. He is as nuanced as they come as a writer. As it relates to John Rahm, I think it's fair to say that he probably did harbor these feelings, and he's now resigned to the fact that he was not the impetus for change or the agitator for change that he initially thought he was going to be when he jumped to LIV Golf last winter. I still believe that John Rahm will go down as one of the best players of all time as a European. I do believe he has, if not the best chance, one of the best chances to complete the career Grand Slam. LIV Golf did not make him any lesser of a force on the world stage. All it has done is made him sort of less relevant or less visible to the golf fan. I think that's the tragedy that's happened in golf over the past 9 months. Is it certainly looked like, if you look at the career trajectories of John Rahm and Scottie Scheffler, we could have seen an incredible duel and a rivalry develop between those two players. That's not going to come to pass because they simply are teeing it up 4 times a year against each other.
And Rex, Ryan's right in the sense that it's too small a data sample to say that LIV has had any detrimental effect on John Rahm as a force in the game. These guys just simply have down years. That's probably what John Rahm has. He was in a playoff yesterday on LIV with Brooks Koepka. It's kind of a showdown that we saw at the 2023 Masters. Not much chatter about it out there. If the two biggest silverbacks on that tour are going at each other in a playoff and it still doesn't kind of break through the noise with golf fans at large, is there any hope that they can do anything that would break through at this point?
Well, I think the wrestling match between the two tours, and we talked about this on the podcast, and it kind of came to a head in my mind at the Travelers Championship, coming off of Bryson DeChambeau's victory. He goes to his event on the LIV Tour. All the other top players on the PGA Tour go to the Travelers Championship, a signature event. It felt like that was a bit of a tipping point, because you're right. how much traction do you actually have when you have the world's best player, you have the most recognizable player, you have the most popular player in that moment, and you still don't seem to get much traction with it. This is another good example. You have the PGA Tour playoffs starting in Memphis, and on the other side, you have essentially your two marquee players going head-to-head coming down the stretch, and it still doesn't resonate very well. I think this speaks to, one, the product doesn't seem to be working with the fans at this point, and two, it seems like even if the product was working, it's hard to see it just because of where you don't really have an opportunity to go and tune in and watch the CW, for example.
Ryan, I want to get on this sort of money topic that we're going to be talking about for weeks to come now. And it's sort of an awkward narrative for the PGA Tour because the playoffs has been built up in recent years towards the big payoff, particularly at least like $25 million first prize this year in the bonus payouts for the FedEx Cup. Is that now an awkward scenario that the PGA Tour has kind of painted itself into a corner when we have all of this sentiment that fans are somewhat turned off by all of this talk of money?
I mean, I certainly think when the FedEx Cup started back in 2007, it was all about the money. That was the only conversation starter that we actually had. The fact that these guys are making so much money now that it's almost an afterthought, or it's rendered a moot point that Scottie Scheffler could potentially win another $25 million for taking home the top prize. I think that pushes season earnings to like $60 million. And that doesn't even include any of the off the golf course endorsements or other projects that he may have. I think the PGA Tour is smart in sort of leaning into the legacy aspect of what a FedEx Cup title could mean. I think certainly this year in 2024, it's leaning into the competitive aspect with those two alphas and Scottie Scheffler and Xander Schauffele going head to head in what is a very much a spirited race and debate for player of the year honors. That's the narrative of 2024, because at this point, $25 million comparatively to Scottie Scheffler's career earnings. I mean, it's already like a quarter of what Scottie Scheffler's earned in his career. He's only been on the PGA Tour for 4 years. So the dialogue has certainly changed as the FedEx Cup has evolved over the past 17 years.
Well, Rex, Lav just mentioned it. He mentioned the narrative of the race between the Alphas 1 and 2, Scottie and Xander for Player of the Year. How would you narrate this thing as Xander went T2, Scottie finished 4th there in Memphis? Is it intensifying in your eyes, or it's still Scottie and there's nobody else?
No, I think it's as muddy as it was at the water in Memphis, because you look at what this playoffs is going to decide. I think it's a political season, so I'll keep it in that context. Scottie Scheffler is clearly leading the polls at the moment, but the margin of error could go either way because of what we've seen in the playoffs. The Lab's point, I think, to the players, the playoffs have become more important. To go back to 2021 to prove the point, coming into the playoffs, John Rahm probably was the front runner to win that year's Player of the Year award. But Patrick Cantlay caught fire in the playoffs, won twice. He ended up getting that vote. And I think that was an indication from the membership that the playoffs matter. And this would be another example. Scottie Scheffler has done some amazing things on the golf course, but there is a scenario, a universe, where Xander Schauffele plays well in Memphis, like he did. Maybe he wins the BMW and goes on to win the FedEx Cup. I think a good portion of the membership would vote for Xander Schauffele because of what that has proven to them over the course of the year. Now, I'm with Scottie. I don't believe it's a season-long race, but the players look at it that way.
Rex.
Yeah, and I would agree, Rex, that I believe this is like the doomsday scenario for the PGA Tour, because over the past couple years, since they went to this staggered start format, we've always wondered, like, what will happen when a player is by far and away the best player during the course of the regular season on the PGA Tour. Scottie Scheffler's 6 wins. It's the first 6-win season we've seen on the PGA Tour in 15 years. He has been, at least through one event, very competitive in the FedEx Cup playoffs, and then he does not win the FedEx Cup. Like, this feels like a slow burn until we get to Eastlake and the Tour Championship. You look at what Xander Schauffele has done at Eastlake over the past 3 years. He is 30 shots better than Scottie Scheffler over the past 3 years at Eastlake. I know the golf course has been renovated. I know it's going to take a little bit of course knowledge and some homework week of. That is a huge advantage that Xander's going to enjoy week of. It feels like he is still the favorite in my mind for FedEx Cup champion. That's really going to muddy the Player of the Year race.
Rex, final question. I want to ask you, because you've been around a lot longer than the fresh-faced kid Ryan Lavner. Sam Saunders announced his retirement this weekend. Arnold Palmer's grandson, never won on tour, became a familiar figure out there. Do we kind of underestimate how difficult it is for people who come from a famous lineage to make it in golf? You know, it was tough for Jack's kids, for Gary Player's kids, for Raymond Floyd's kids.
And I think Sam embraced it. I think we do underestimate. You have that shadow hanging over you. Certainly Charlie Woods is going to face that over the course of his career if he goes on to a profession. I mean, it goes on to become a professional golfer. But I will go immediately to what Sam sort of pivoted to after Arnold Palmer passed away. He took the torch. He became the lead voice when it came to the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Here in the community in Orlando, he's become the lead voice. So it's difficult, and he struggled with it from time to time. But I will give him a monsoon of credit because eventually he embraced it.
Always fun kicking around everything in golf that's worth talking about with Rex and Ryan. Thanks for the time, guys.
Thank you.
We'll stick around for hour two of golf today. We're going to keep the roundtable theme going. Some of the best who cover the women's game. And with a major in St. Andrews, there's a lot to talk about. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Golf Today. Flashback to 2007 when 25-year-old Irina Ochoa won her first major title at the AIG Women's Open. It was the first time the event was contested at the home of golf, the Old Course in St. Andrews. 6 years later, 2013, the AIG Women's Open returned to the Old Course where American Stacey Lewis captured her second career major title. She's the last player to win the Women's Open at the Old. Well, someone else gets a shot this week. The event returns to St. Andrews, the final round, final major of 2024, and you can catch live first round coverage this Thursday at 7 a.m. Eastern Time right here on Golf Channel. And it's time now for another Golf Today roundtable as we say hello to Amy Rogers and Grant Boone. It kind of sounds like a couple of Broadway producers we have right here, Rogers and Boone. Amy, I want to start with you. Lauren Coghlan, she's the story of the last few weeks. She just won the Women's Scottish Open at the weekend. It was her second career victory just a couple of weeks after her first career victory. How improbable would all this have seemed just a few weeks ago?
Yeah, I think if you told Lauren Coghlan even a beginning of the year or a year ago, she wouldn't have believed you that this is the fate of her season so far. Two wins, two top tens in her last five starts. And this is a journey woman who's really plodded along since 2018, splitting her time between the LPGA and the Epson Tour, has found a second gear this season. When I spoke to her at the Chevron Championship, the first major of the year, early in the season where she was in the hunt, she had made a putter change, made some changes to her team, switched up her caddy, had her husband John Pond on the bag, and also brought in a veteran caddy in Terry McNamara this season, who used to caddy for Annika Sorenstam. So these changes have paid huge dividends for Lauren Coghlan now as she comes into this AIG Women's Open looking for her third top 10 finish in a major this season. And I think just her performance last week, winning in Scotland at Dundonald Links, I was there covering the championship a few years ago, and this is a fantastic test, a great tune-up for women that are making the trip over to the Old Course this week. For her to start out with a bogey start and to bounce back and to get the win in some tough conditions and wind, there was plenty of that, I think is a huge testament to Lauren Coghlan and her character as she's just competing in this AIG Women's Open for the third time. Only recently began qualifying for this major, competed the last 2 years where she's made the cut, but I really don't feel like we can judge Lauren Coghlan based on her past performance because this is a completely different Lauren Coghlan in 2024.
Grant, what has not been completely different has been the majors and the results. It's been brand names in the first four this year with the fifth and final pending. It's hard not to go back to 2020 and think about Sofia Popoff, who came virtually out of nowhere, 304th in the world, to go ahead and qualify, get there, and win this thing. I'm not saying that happens. That seems outlandish to be repeated. But is there maybe somebody outside of the brand name world to focus in on this week?
Well, a few weeks ago, we might have said Miyu Yamashita was in that camp. But, you know, she's now number 20 in the world. Miyu has played from Japan. She doesn't play on the LPGA Tour. And according to her team, that's not necessarily in the offing for later this year. But Miyu is just 23 years old. She's a multiple winner on the JLPGA. And she's gotten into some big events because of her Rolex ranking, and all of those wins on the JLPGA have moved her up. Well, she finished 17th at the Chevron Championship. She tied for 12th at the U.S. Women's Open at Lancaster. She tied for second at the KPMG Women's PGA, which, with her birdie on the 72nd hole, got her into the Olympic Games. And then she, you know, birdied her last hole on Friday to make the cut at Evian. So And then she competed in the Olympic Games and had a great chance to medal there until a mishap of the ninth hole in the final round on Saturday. So I don't think it's fair to count the 20th ranked player in the world maybe as a dark horse. But I go back to Hinako Shibuno in 2019 when she won at Woburn. She was not a dark horse in terms of the ranking. She was inside the top 50, but she had never played in outside of Asia before. Only once had she ever left her home of Japan. She got to Woburn, Eamon, you'll love this, thinking it was a Lynx course because she heard, I'm going to the UK. It's going to be Lynx. And she found out it was not that, and it didn't matter. She was the smiling Cinderella, and she won. So perhaps Yamashita, her countrywoman, could follow in her footsteps.
We've got to give Grant props here for the flex in the background. In terms of his backdrop, he's really got everyone beaten this week. There are no biceps. You do have the R&A clubhouse, Grant, but you don't have any biceps. Amy,
no,
when you look at...
I have uniceps. That's all I've got.
Amy, when you look at that leaderboard from Scotland at the weekend, there was a lot of star power on that. A lot of big names who've been in form lately who are playing well heading to St. Andrews. Who is your eye on to make some kind of a statement this week?
Yeah, kudos to Grant on the background. My fake plant back here really can't hold a candle to the R&A clubhouse. Pretty impressive, Grant. Nice work out of you on
that one. I'm in Tom Abbott's room, by the way.
Well, like Grant, I mean, you start feeling like you're picking these dark horses, but really when they're still within the top 20 in the world, you feel like it's not that much of a long shot. I think one player I'll be keeping an eye on is Ashley Buhai. She played well in the Olympics just a few weeks ago. She has contended, obviously won an AIG Women's Open in the past. And there are a handful of players that were in the field here at the Old Course back in 13 that are returning, that played well. And Ashley Buhai, one of those few players, she finished inside the top 50. But I like the chances of someone like an Anna Nordqvist, who has played well. She won at Carnoustie. She was tied for 11th at the AIG Women's Open back in 2013 at St. Andrews. So I like the chances someone this week that knows what it takes to handle one of these tough link style layouts and maybe even played well here several years back.
And this is the third Women's Open to be held at the Old Course. Grant, I think it's fair to say that two things that contribute to a sense of respect or equity in this game are venues and money. And this is the most iconic venue in all of sports, certainly outside of the United States when it comes to golf. The AIG gets some props for how they've kept pace with the purse just in the last few years. How important in your mind are those developments in terms of giving this championship the stature it deserves?
Well, I heard what Jordan and you were discussing earlier, and I couldn't agree more. The way that Morgan Pressel, our colleague, says it is venues matter. And when you go to Sahali, where we've watched, you know, some cool moments happen in years past in both men's and women's golf, when you go to places like the Old Course, where, you know, the game was born, and where we've watched the greatest players in the world hoist claret jugs and AIG Women's Open trophies, it does matter. And I think it's also worth noting, this is the 24th year that this has been a major championship designated as such by the LPGA. 30 years ago, it became an official LPGA event, but it wasn't until 2001 that it was designated as a major. But this is also the first time it's been contested here at the Old Course since the R&A took over management of this AIG Women's Open. Previously, it was the Ladies Golf Union. And I think that's another small but important note in terms of how this championship has emerged, has evolved, has grown. You're 100% correct to credit AIG and Peter Zaffino and what his group have done to elevate the purse. Then you go to these great venues. It doesn't always have to be the most famous venue in sport like the Old Course. It can be Walton Heath, a phenomenal golf course. Otherwise, Tom Abbott wouldn't be a member, of course. Next year, we go to Porthcawl in Wales. Just like Lancaster, the U.S. Women's Open, not a lot of people knew about Lancaster until it hosted the U.S. Women's Open in 2015. We saw what an amazing place it was then and was this year. So venues matter, as Morgan says. Morgan, by the way, the 54-hole leader going into the 2013 AIG Women's Open final round. The conditions are going to always be important here. And with the light rain falling, this, I think, is the sprinkle before the storm. We're expecting conditions that Eamon and Jordan and Amy, they described as, in this delightful Scottish way, unsettled. It's the term they use for later in the week. So I think when you wake up in the U.S. and you watch golf in the U.K., you kind of want to see a little unsettled, don't you?
No question. No question about that. Amy, as we gear up for this final major of the year, final is a word that looms large for Lexi Thompson and her expected retirement. Could be the last one. Expected to be last major we see for her. Of course, you never do know. But what do you expect her emotions to be coming up to this one?
Oh, I would imagine they're going to be extremely high. That's going to be the biggest test for her this week, is managing those emotions. But to your point, she has kept the door open, saying that she doesn't plan to play a full schedule beyond the end of this season. But that's keeping the door open, that she could potentially come back. But what a way to go out. We've talked about Lydia Ko possibly having this mic drop moment at the Olympics and just walking away. Or maybe she gets the win this week and just leaves. But what a finish that would be for Lydia, or for Lexi Thompson, to cap off her career at the home of golf, of all places. And I noticed that this week as I was looking at the field, and then there's a dozen past champions that are returning. I think everyone just wants to seize upon this opportunity to get to compete at the Old Course. And who would want to hang it up before they get a chance to do that this week? And what a way to go out that would be for Lexi Thompson.
Grant, there's got to be a certain appeal for the golf architecture nerds and the ball rollback aficionados this week to actually see the greatest course in golf, when it won't actually be overpowered. Perhaps there is somebody in the field this week who's actually going to overpower it. But for the golf nerds, this is going to look like the best in the world playing the golf course in the way that it's meant to be played.
I agree. I mean, this place is, it can be demure, it can be cutesy. At times, it's diminutive by modern standards, but you better be mindful when the wind begins to blow, because we think it's going to blow a lot this week. And when the wind blows, I mean, you just kind of throw the yardage book out. I mean, Lydia Ko even last week was talking about hitting three woods, 175 yards, which I know, Eamon, for you is a stock three wood, but I mean, for most of these players, yeah, it's not about, and this is what I love about it, it's not about playing swing, it's about playing golf and finding a way. And really, isn't that what the game is about? This place is oozing with history. I was talking to Judy Rankin, who's called so many big events here for ABC and ESPN back in the day, and she just said, you feel like you're stepping into history when you're in St. Andrews, and everything about a town, but just the golf course itself. You know, you have a couple of par fives, you know, and on a given day you can reach them, but you can drive a couple of par fours, or maybe not. Maybe it's hang on for dear life. I just saw Andrea Lee a moment ago walking past, and she said she played yesterday, and she said she could barely stand up on a couple of holes. The wind was blowing so hard. So it's about playing golf and finding a way. And I do think if we see that you're going to see what we saw a little bit of over the weekend at the ISPS Hand of Women Scottish Open on the other coast, on the Ayrshire coast, and that is the best ball strikers will emerge, and Lauren Coghlan is as good as there is in all of golf. It was no surprise that she and Charlie Hull were right up there at the top, Megan Kang, all supreme ball strikers. When the wind really howls, you better be able to control your ball, and we think it's going to howl this week.
Certainly howling, at least out of the gates to start the season, Amy, was Nelly Korda, who's gone relatively quiet. Last time we saw her was at Paris. Didn't go as planned for her there, nor as of recent with her golf game. What are, I don't want to say expectations, but what are you looking to see from one of the world's best to get back on track?
I think I'm looking to see which Nelly Korda shows up at the Old Course. I feel like as we were watching the Olympics, it almost varied shot to shot or hole to hole in which Nelly Korda we were seeing. There were flashes of brilliance where you would see these moments that reminded us of what lifted her to six victories early in this season. And then just that quickly with the swing of a club or the next hole, suddenly that all seemed to unravel. And so it's been really hard, I think, to just kind of get a pulse on where Nelly Korda is right now. And it seems like she would probably say the same thing, where it just kind of varies shot to shot. And to Grant's point, when you're dealing with a course like the Old Course, where you're dealing with so many natural elements, so many little bumps and intricacies and undulations and challenges, if you're not sure where you are with your game, what form of this player is going to show up, I can't imagine that that's going to be a very comforting feeling for Nelly Korda, trying to navigate her way around the Old Course. I would imagine it's going to be quite difficult for her to kind of find her way around. So to your point, the last time we saw her was at the Olympics. She did take a week off and now makes her trip here to the final major of the season. So I'm sure she was doubling down with her team after that disappointing finish there in Paris, trying to get her game back on track and just trying to recapture some of that magic that we saw from her earlier this season.
Grant, you mentioned that it was 2001 that this became recognized as a major championship on the LPGA Tour. Let's play devil's advocate here for a moment. Is there an argument to be made that it should be retroactively counted beyond that? So Carrie Webb gets another couple of majors, Patty Sheehan does, and maybe Laura Davies gets into the LPGA Tour Hall of Fame where she belongs.
You know, I've made that case for the Chevron Championship to every commissioner going back, I can't remember how many, that should have been the case, because in my opinion, you look back at the Chevron Championship and from day one, it had big money. It was on television, which very few LPGA events were back then. It was a major in every sense. It just wasn't designated one for the first 11 years until 1983. In terms of this one, one of the arguments that one of the commissioners told me was, well, you shouldn't get a major if you didn't know you were playing for one, which comes as big news to Gene Sarazen, who is credited as winning the career Grand Slam. He didn't know that the Masters in 1935 was going to one day, the Augusta National Invitation Tournament was going to be a modern day major. Do we give Tom Morris, old Tom, young Tom, do we give them majors? You know, how many guys were in the field? A dozen or so in that very first Open Championship in 1860. We do that. I will say that until 1994, there weren't an abundance of American players coming over. The field was largely it was a British Open. It was somewhat parochial in that sense. And so that would be the argument against it. But again, I think if you look at what has happened on the men's side, I don't think anyone's, you know, lost a lot of sleep that Reg Whitcomb, you know, is a major champion or others, you know, down through the years.
Amy and Grant, what a week. It's shaping up to be a major on the line and at the Old Course. Doesn't get any better than that. Thank you guys for the time. Look, a lot of action over the weekend that has us kind of looking to this weekend with some potential, like, oh, I could see this playing out. And one of those things for me is I'm starting to watch Victor Hovland a little bit. I think he might have something here.
Yeah, Victor certainly found a spark this week as well. And there's going to be so much interest to see who makes that top 30 cutoff. Yeah. To make their way to Eastlake. And certainly a lot of interest on the other side of the pond as well when we get to the Old Course for St. Andrews. And I'm kind of wondering what we're missing this week. Dame Laura Davies decided not to make a start this year. She didn't want to walk over the bridge. She said she'd just be taking a place in the field. The last Women's Open held without Laura Davies in the field was 1979.
How about that?
She made her start as a 16-year-old amateur back in 1980, but she's not going for 44 in a row.
Class then, class now, in making a decision like that. But, you know, Eamon, it really stood out to me from today's show, your comment on the tour, LPGA, being there at the Old Course and what that means. So everybody should be dialed in for that one. Pretty cool stuff.
I think we get all the storylines we want this week.
There you go. That's Eamon Lynch. I'm Jordan Cornette. Have a good day, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.